This is Game Theory, a podcast about competition, strategy, and decision-making, hosted by me, Nick Andrews, and my brother Chris. In this episode, sports. In episode 38, we have something a little different for you. We take our time and we discuss good things and mostly bad things that are going on with America's sports leagues. Don't get us wrong, we love every sport for the most part. We just wanted to examine various things that are happening from an existential point in all of America's sports leagues. It's more of a free-flowing and conversational episode, and it's our longest one, so let us know if that's something that you like or don't like. Remember, you can contact us by our email address. It's in the show notes. You can follow us on various social media platforms, and you can watch this episode probably in its entirety on YouTube. We hope you enjoy our conversation about the state of sports in America, including NCAA football, NFL football, Major League Baseball, hockey, and, of course, NBA basketball. And welcome to episode 38 of Game Theory, your podcast about competition, strategy, decision-making, and kind of policy, and whatever we want, to be honest, Chris. In this episode, we're talking about the state of sports in America. We're going to do our best not to talk about officiating because we know it's bad. We got it. Like, I have replay. I have the internet. So we're going to try to talk about existential crises and long-term conversations for leagues and players and big picture kind of stuff. And we're just going to kind of shoot from the hip and do a checkup on sports in the United States. But before we do that, Elizabeth Holmes, Chris, that episode was fun. This Fraudster File thing is getting exciting. I like this series. We're going to keep doing that.
Yeah, of the two fraudsters we've had, Elizabeth Holmes, by far the worst. Billy McFarland, as time goes on, the more I realize, he was just an idiot. Elizabeth Holmes was devious.
Yeah.
And that was a fun episode to make. And I'm pretty interested to see what other fraudsters are going to make the list and where they're going to stack up.
We are going to do a subcategory of fraudsters that are love fraudsters that get their teeth in a person and take all their money. Those are fun. We'll tell you which documentaries to watch. Yeah, so one annoying metaphor for me is when you see online when someone is playing chess, not checkers, because that is used all the time. Also, 3D chess. All chess is 3D chess. Computers
actually, exist. All chess is 4D chess.
Correct.
Well, that's not true. No. Online chess is only 3D.
Correct.
All over the board chess is 3D chess.
I agree. Yes. But Elizabeth 40. Holmes versus Billy McFarland, that is chess versus checkers.
It is.
Billy
McFarland was really playing roulette.
He was.
Checkers is too strong of a game for him.
Absolutely. So the newsletter for Game Theory should be ready to go Labor Day weekend. We're just going to find a couple things. We talked about that. You can subscribe to it. I'm going to try to do a newsletter with every episode. If you'd like to sign up, the ability to do that will come in the next couple weeks, depending on when you listen to this. That's August in the year of our Lord 2022. It'll be all available in the show notes. The other thing, Chris, is that we're growing our little YouTube audience, which means I'm going to have to care more about YouTube and put clips and stuff on the internet. If you want to see us, you can't watch us on Spotify. You have to watch us on YouTube. One, because I don't want to give Spotify my face. I already gave Google my face. They can have it. And number two, because we want you to watch on YouTube. YouTube is more fun, and it's a more good place for creators and for viewers. The other thing is giving us a 5-star rating in the Apple podcast place. I don't have an iPhone. It helps us with algorithms a lot. It shows that Apple, like, this is a good podcast, not just one that people listen to, but a good one, and it can help people a lot. So if you care about us, do those things. We're very close to doing the show weekly, and we did 4 episodes in the month of July, most ever.
That's a lot of episodes.
It is. Yeah, we had the bonus.
That's 4 times as many as our normal number of episodes for July.
Yeah, that's quite a bit too many. You can email us. All the contact information is in the show notes. Twitter, Instagram. I would give me a B- at Twitter, and I give you a hard C+. It's not really our platform, but we are there.
Excuse me?
Oh, yeah, you heard me. You heard me. Yeah.
You get A+ content. That's at ChrisAndrews315. No explanation for that other than 307 was taken.
307 was taken. So you're like, oh, 8. 8 is a reasonable number to add to this.
I think it was a long time ago when I used to be in shape, and I think it had to do with the weight of a bar with 3 plates on either side, which I thought was impressive at the time, but then I just got done watching World's Strongest Man finals from the last year, and it's genuinely lighter than the weights that those guys like warm up with before the real exercise activity. It's crazy.
That is crazy. You know, you think about like what people can do. Nick Chubb for the Cleveland Browns was just videoed at 7:05 with what's called something called an earthquake bar, which I didn't know existed, which is apparently one that bounces on purpose so that you have to fight gravity on purpose.
Off the ground?
Yes, like it's super pliable metal so that it jiggles on purpose, which So that means if you're not smooth all the way up, you have to like reload and reload. So if you don't, if you're not smooth with your squat, it like will bring you back down. And you have to fight through it, which is one of the crazy. I did not know that existed. That's a wild thing to have existed.
When was the last time you did a smooth squat?
Oh, well, I mean, I do one every morning.
Was it during the Obama administration?
One big one every morning. You'll know when you get
anyway,
my Wordle
watch
score.
Us on YouTube.
Yeah, why well, you'll know when you get my Wordle score. Speaking of Wordle and other things that people care about, we're talking about sports today. The way that this episode is going to work is we're going to cover five sports. We may dabble into other things in sports in general. The where we talk about your league, and this is America, FIFA, they've got it figured out. They're corrupt and successful, and we're not going to address any international soccer. We're addressing the state of sports in America. The leagues that we're doing are college football, NFL football, National Hockey League, Major League Baseball, and the National Basketball Association. We may dip into LIV Golf. In the description, you can jump to whichever league you want to do. At the end, we're going to be doing baseball, we're going to be doing college football, and then in the middle is NFL football. Coming up next, we're going to do the National Basketball Association. We're going to start with America's pastime, Major League Baseball. Chris, when was the last time you watched a baseball game on television for more than an hour in a row with the volume up and not doing anything?
I sincerely cannot remember. I think it was probably when the Tigers were good. I think I remember watching them in their playoff run in, I want to say, 2013 or 2014. It was when the A's had Yanis Cespedes, and I was planning to go to game three of their series in Detroit. And
oh, that's right.
I think I watched game two, maybe. But it was a long, long time ago. Certainly not since... You know, I've voted for president twice more recently than I've watched a full adult baseball game.
So it's really interesting that you say that, because that's one thing that's starting to happen more and more. And I have a hot take about baseball and NCAA football that I will save for later. But we're going to start with baseball. The issue is that baseball is so regionally focused, and people are so they care about their teams. But also because there's no salary cap and it's not built for parity, people don't give a shit if their team's not good. And there are teams, because of something that we'll get into in a minute, that there's no incentive to be good. None. It's literally wasting money. Even winning a World Series, like, is the return on investment on this good? No, it really isn't. Which is
when we talked about this during the Moneyball episode too. Right. I mean, the question that professional athletes are trying to answer is one that they're answering on behalf of the owner of their team.
Right.
Because these teams are privatized and because they're owned by somebody else who has an incentive to make money, the question that the professional athletes are asking is, do I want to win games or does this franchise want to make money?
Right.
And that question is asked and answered by decisions made by the owner, the GM, the athletes, where they want to go, how they want to negotiate their salaries. And the result of that is that you don't always have a competitive league where every team is showing up to play to win games. Sometimes teams are showing up to play to lose. I mean, if anybody out there is a fan of or is aware of the existence of the Cincinnati Reds this season, you'll understand that it's sometimes the prerogative of professional sports teams to just completely tank their own reputation and embarrass themselves and lose day in and day out. And it's for the purpose of making money down the road. It's a long-term investment for a shitty season to get higher returns on season tickets and merch and whatever else, TV deals and all kinds of stuff down the road.
Right, exactly. And like, so it's very, tanking is a very clear situation in the NHL, NBA, and NFL because, and this is the big, there are two existential crises and one thing that is pissing me off that we're going to talk about. The two existential crises or like situations, good and bad, are robot umpires, which we'll talk about in a second. But the bigger one to me is the relationship between ownership and other owners and ownership and the players. So the MLB players have one of the strongest unions that has ever existed in the history of the world, right up there with U.S. steelworkers and electricians. Like, they are so strong. They all fall in line, which is crazy because even in sports, there's the 1%. There's the 1% of the 1%, and then there are kings. Among players, there are like five guys that decide what happens, and then dudes who will never make that money just agree with them, which is crazy how unions work, I suppose. But having a strong union is really helpful to negotiate. The problem, Chris, is, and this is where the difference is and why this can happen. Major League Baseball is the last sport in North America that doesn't have a salary cap. And what that means is that along with the salary cap, there's a salary floor. In the NFL, NHL, and NBA, teams are required to spend a minimum amount of money over a two-year period, which means they can't just suck on purpose. Major League Baseball doesn't have either of those. So not only can some teams spend as much as they want, other teams don't have to spend anything. Comma, hyphen, M dash. I don't know.
We'll start a new sentence.
Period.
It's almost never the case that you're going to use a semicolon. You're not going to use an M dash. I know you know what it is. Congratulations. You're very clever.
It's literally my job. Just I write for a
living. Put a period and capitalize the next word. Start a new sentence. I promise you're going to be better off that way.
The other problem is, and why this is different, is that Major League Baseball does not have a league-wide revenue sharing thing. So if the Commanders in Washington, your favorite team down the road in Washington, when they have a sellout crowd, a certain amount of that money is supposed to be allocated to the rest of the league so that the Lions make some money and the Giants make some money. And everybody makes a little money. It's one big pot and they all split it up. Baseball doesn't do that. So your TV contracts are regional. So if you're like the Reds, the Rockies, the A's, which are teams I'm going to pick on here, Cincinnati is not competitive with New York in terms of media market, in terms of anything. Nothing. There's nothing competitive about that. So your revenue, you have some slice of a pie and a different kind of revenue sharing model, but it's so small compared to how much money you need to make that it's irrelevant to you. One great way to improve margin is just to stop paying players a ton of money and just to get a bunch of cheap players. Because of this, there's no incentives for teams to try. There's incentive for teams to help the bottom line. And anytime a business stops investing in growth and starts cutting costs, it's time to be concerned. And baseball incentivizes that. Which is crazy. So you're literally, as a fan, it's just on the whim of ownership. If they want to win, they'll try. If they don't, they won't. And if you're paying a player, you know, Bryce Harper's making like $400 million over 13 years, which is crazy, someone's got to pay that. And the other owners aren't really helping out with it, which creates a situation where teams literally are half-assing it just to make money. Like the Rockies are the damnedest one because they've been the league's minor league system for years. They don't give a shit. That ownership group is never going to try, ever. Every now and then they buy a guy that'll put asses in the seats, a good looking dude who hits home runs so that people will go to games because Colorado is objectively fun. They're never going to try to win a championship because there's no reason to.
Yeah, all this kind of horse shit about how can you not be romantic about baseball? I think that comes up every once in a while when like a fat guy runs really fast around the bases and makes it farther than expected. People start talking about romance in baseball. When somebody hits two home runs in a shorter period of time than the average, and people are like, oh, how can you not be romantic about baseball? It used to be when they had the stupid situation of pitchers hitting baseballs, people would get all excited and all misty-eyed about pitchers hitting home runs when it happened twice a year. And it's horseshit, you guys. I mean, baseball is there to make money for the owners, and the lack of a salary floor and the lack of a salary cap are distinct evidence of that. Yep. So if you want to be romantic about the Seattle Mariners' chances of ever winning a World Series, stop it. It's when you understand that this is just a business, this is just a revenue machine for people who are already ultra-wealthy, then there's no reason to be anything other than cynical unless you're like one of the top two or three teams that get to decide how things are going to go in the league this year. Right. Unless you're the Chicago Cubs or the New York Yankees and you Dodgers, have so much money you don't know what to do with it, you're just not going to have enough influence on the future of the league to like make it competitive or fun. So congratulations to fans in those markets. Everybody else, like, I mean, you gotta take it with a grain of salt and stop tearing up over baseball.
Yeah. And it's funny because occasionally a team will accidentally be really good. Like the Marlins won the World Series in the last 25 years twice accidentally. And then they sold everybody. They were cheap. They won when they were young. They got them out of there. They did that literally twice, which is kind of an interesting way to do it. The other thing that is really driving me nuts is this length of game thing. So I had a weird moment of realization. So there are two things happening strategically in baseball that are causing a weird situation. You just mentioned pitchers hitting. The other thing is the shift. So in the most recent collective bargaining agreement, you got two infielders on each side, first base, second base, shortstop, third stop. What teams have been doing is moving the shortstop or the second baseman over to another side. So there's 3-1, and they do that based on the analytics of the person that they're pitching to and how often they just hit it to that spot. It has dramatically decreased the amount of singles and doubles that we're seeing in professional baseball. The other thing is that we've done away with pitchers hitting in the National League. Now, every pitcher's not going to hit. There are designated hitters, except for Shohei Ohtani, the best athlete in the world. What's interesting, Chris, is I didn't realize that I can't both want games to be faster and not want pitchers to hit and the shift. Because pitchers hitting and the shift are outs. And the more guaranteed or high like likelihood outs there are, the faster the game is. But if I want offense, so objectively, this is just the first time it dawned on me recently, you can't have more offense and faster games. It is not mathematically possible. The only way is if people just consistently hit more home runs, and they're trying to, but if you eliminate singles, the game will move fast. It'll be more boring, but it'll move faster. I think, oh my God, what are they going to do? So they got rid of the shift, and I thought, uh-oh, that's the opposite. Singles are dumb. I don't care. Unless there's a runner on base, and if there's a runner on base, they wouldn't shift. Singles are stupid. Let the pitchers hit, because then we can get out of here. That's 60%. 60% of the time, they're just going to, like, they're barely going to try. They're not even going to try. Like, just get them out. Let's move the game along. Or we're going to go for more offense. 11 to 8 games take 4 hours. What are we going to do?
I can't think of a good reason for games to continue to 9 innings. Just shorten the damn games to 7 innings. The average will still play themselves out. Shit, throw in another game.
Yeah.
Add a few more games to the schedule and make them shorter. Because, you know, I don't know. It's just so boring. It's just so fucking boring to watch the same thing happen over and over again. Remember that Roy D. Mercer tape we used to have?
Yeah.
It was prank like, calls, yeah. I would rather take an all-day ass-whooping than watch some guy named Troy or Tito spit sunflower seeds for 5.5 hours. It's just such a boring game. And it's a question of, like, do we make this faster or shorter, or do we just have less of it? I don't know.
Yeah. What's interesting is, so we go back to the revenue sharing model. When you have 82 home games, that's how you make your money, because they're not making it on TV from other teams and that, like, people are actually watching. So every game is like its own thing. So all you have to do is drum up some, like, even like good weather is a reason to go to a game for 5 minutes, and that money goes to the owners. So, like, nobody's really watching the games anyway, especially if the teams are like mediocre or bad. What I find really kind of interesting and disappointing is that there's because the union is so strong and their like player camaraderie is so strong, there is a culture of silencing individuality in baseball that has killed it. So I just watched Little League World Series qualifiers where a kid did a bat flip on a home run. It's like, yeah, if you did that in the pros, you'd be thrown at. They're treating it like it's a Wall Street bank. Like, dude, like, Fernando Tatis wants to grab his junk and point at a pitcher. Like, I want that. And you're going to get him out 70% of the time, probably more than that anyway. So if he points at you and then you throw at his head and then he gets yelled at for trying and then all of this crap, it's just like, they're not people. They become robots. So the bigger issue to me for, like, I feel bad for baseball truists. They're going to hate this so much. There's too many minor league players. There are too many players. I don't understand how minor leagues work. There are too many minor leagues. Like, nobody goes to those games. Sometimes they take their kids and their dogs, and that's fine. Why the fuck are the White Sox paying some guy that's never going to make it? Why are they spending our resources on ballpark?
Why does Billings, Montana have a professional baseball team?
Right. And, like, there's one here in Winston-Salem. And, like, they're a single-A affiliate. They exist solely for Luis Robert or whoever is hurt to come up and get some pitches and warm back up. But then what happens? And this is what really sucks. By the time they get to the pros, all of their individuality has been beaten out of them by this stupid system that they have to go through 3 years. They're like, oh, I'm just happy to be out here. No, dude. Remember, like, when you watch the league, look how much fun these kids are having. And those 12-year-olds that get jacked and have to watch a bat flip have more maturity than the men who then throw at their head. And, like, I have to care about this now. Like, this has to be a thing. Like, oh, you're an answer for that. You show up the pitchers. Just suck my ass. How about that? Stop me. Cam Newton had the greatest point in the year that he was the best football player we've ever seen with the Panthers. Like, if you don't like what I do, stop me.
Yeah, I mean, baseball's a sport for adult crybabies.
I do.
A couple years ago, the Padres had that dude who hit 2 home runs in a game, yeah, and the other team, like, lectured him. Like, stop doing that.
Because they were up a lot. They were winning by, like, 8, and then he hit a grand slam, and they're like, you need to not do it. Like, what the fuck?
The whole unwritten rules thing, like, it's a sport for adult crybabies. And honestly, Nick, the biggest problem with professional baseball isn't a money sharing revenue bullshit. It's none of that. It's that the game is fucking boring and people take it seriously.
Yeah, they're taking.
Let's move
on to
another more interesting topic. This is so boring. I don't give a shit about any of this.
I do love playoff baseball, but playoffs in general are great, and I'm a huge Tigers fan, and I will always be. Let's move on to the National Hockey League, where they have this is an actual mathematical problem, Chris, and it's fucking hilarious. They've incentivized tying more than trying to win. And that, to me, is absolutely hysterical. So let's go through the state of the league. The other issue we're going to have is that there are two countries Like I know that like there is a basketball team in Canada and there's a baseball team in Canada, but the NHL has seven teams in Canada, which creates a bunch of really interesting issues. But we're going to start with this point situation. So in the National Hockey League, if you win a hockey game, you get 2 points and they count to your standings. If you lose a hockey game, you get 0 points. However, if you lose a game in overtime or in a shootout, you get 1 point. As a result of that, when teams get to overtime, there's not really a reason to go too hard and risk losing. Teams that have more overtime losses are higher in the standings than teams that have more losses. So that you can lose more in overtime and be higher in the standings than teams that have fewer losses than you. It's bananas. This is a complete, it's a conundrum. And it's a huge problem.
Yeah, I'm looking at an article from this guy named Matthew Rutledge Taylor. He wrote this in 2010. And he said, this has been bothering me for 12 years now. So here we are, fully 24 years after poor Matthew was first bothered by this issue. And there have been a bunch of like clever ideas. But like one of the things that gets me about these ideas about how to like change the point systems in pro leagues, it reminds me of like ranked choice voting.
Yeah.
Or you ever heard of quadratic voting?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, like, yeah.
It's people that are just so clever, too clever by half. And like anybody can tinker around with those points, but like, I don't know. I don't know that it's going to make, I don't know that it would make a huge deal. Like one of the proposals that people have to stop incentivizing teams from tying is to make outright wins worth more points than wins in overtime.
Yeah.
So rather than 2 points for a win or 2 points for an overtime win, you get 3 points for an outright win and 2 points for an overtime win. I don't know. I feel like that just penalizes teams that are competing really hard and happen to tie games.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's something to be said for the fact that teams are tying so often. I mean, okay, you're playing not to lose, but I mean, you still got to be good at hockey to do that. I mean, that to me is worth more than just losing a hockey game. Like I don't have a problem with teams that are more successful being higher in the standings than teams that are less successful.
Yeah, it comes to this. This is something else I wanted to mention in baseball, where they let position players pitch because they don't want to use a pitcher. It's very similar to that in hockey, where you can have like 2 or 3 minutes left and both teams will just kind of agree to take a knee and take the point. And unless they're in the same division, there's no incentive to try. And I think that anytime rules incentivize teams not to try to win the game, that's a game theory issue. You're in a cooperative situation where you're like, yeah, let's not take any risks. And the other team's like, hey, we're right there with you. So when you have, specifically in the NHL, where there are two divisions and there are two conferences, and in those two conferences, there are two divisions each. If you're playing someone from the other side of the country, there's literally no reason. If you have a tie in hand, you're like, well, that is objectively better than a loss. Them getting a point is irrelevant to us, and it will never be relevant to us until the Stanley Cup final. Who cares? So at that point, you've incentivized both teams to like kind of dance. And that to me is kind of, and it's not every time, but you do see it quite a bit. And as a result of that, like that's kind of a crummy, gross thing that happens. What happens in Europe is similar to what you said with FIFA, and what they figured out is that ties are part of life, which is another part of this that we as Americans, we just can't wrap our brains around. If we tied more, I think things would be interesting. I think people would try to win more. But in international football and in soccer, 3 points for a win, 1 point for a draw. So you have to draw 3 to make it for a win. Still better than nothing, which is how a tie should feel. It shouldn't feel like an active accomplishment, like, oh, I got a point. It should be like, ugh, at least it wasn't a total loss today. At least today wasn't a complete disaster. While winning completely catapults you, right? It's twice as much. It's 100%
One of the things the NHL did to try to address that was, and maybe make the game more exciting, was change the overtime rules. Mm-hmm. So in playoff hockey, overtime is just a continuation of the game. It's just another period of 20 minutes with teams playing 5-on-5, and that's it. In the regular season, though, when there are many more games and they're trying to get more offense and more excitement, but they're also trying to address the problem of teams just settling for a tie, what the NHL did was decrease the number of players on the ice at a given time. So now, instead of playing 5-on-5 hockey for an additional 5 minutes, teams play 3-on-3 hockey.
Right.
And in a sport like hockey, when there's so much skill and so much speed, the more open ice there is, the more action there is, and the more possibility that a team is going to make a mistake or get a huge rush and get some kind of scoring advantage, the more activity can happen on the ice. If hockey was 3-on-3 all the time, it would be the most exciting sport on the planet. I think it already is. Mm. But doing that for overtime puts teams in a different position.
Yep.
Now the question is not, am I okay with settling for a tie because I've got my point? The question is, do I think it's more likely that I'm going to win this game by trying really hard at the end or by waiting for my skill guys to get some rest so that they can be fresh for the 5 minutes and I can secure my second point?
Sure.
So it's not that, I don't think it's that, with that rule change, the NHL, I think, successfully addressed the issue and they made a much more fun product. Overtime hockey fucking rules. Shootouts rule when the 5 minutes of 3-on-3 doesn't.
They don't think so. That's another fun part of this. They hate the shootout.
Well, they're wrong. I mean, they're just straight up wrong about that. Yep. But by making the product more exciting and adding in more space for more players to do more things and show off their skills, they've put teams in a position now where it's like, okay, am I more likely to win when the rules are different? Am I more like, are my skill guys and speed guys faster and better than the other guys?
Yeah.
You know, as we regress toward the mean and add more players on the ice, sure, maybe we'll tie, but I think my top three guys are going to score faster than theirs.
And yeah, it's actually
that changes the calculus.
That's what happens in chess, where the world championships, if there's a tie, they'll play a shortened game. And people are like, is this, I mean, it's still chess technically, but it's like different. That's sort of what the NHL has done here. Like, we're going to make a blitz hockey game in 3 minutes, which hopefully would address the problem that you have to try to win because it's so open ice. But there, I mean, sports get figured out. Coaches have figured out. We can slow it down. The next big problem, I mentioned Canada as a big problem. There are two big problems.
Canada is a big problem.
Huge. That's, second that's biggest good. Problem in the
What's
world.
What's the third big problem?
It's a huge problem. Canada has seven teams. Oh, God. Ottawa, Montreal, Toronto, Winnipeg, Vancouver, Calgary, Edmonton. Got it. Nailed it. Murdered it. Unbelievable. Also Buffalo.
Would you believe that Nick runs a sports podcast, folks?
Buffalo's in Canada, too. The problem with Canada is, so we saw this during COVID, that Canadian restrictions were much different. They had a more difficult time getting their population vaccinated for whatever reason. You can read into that whatever you'd like.
Because they don't have any money.
Correct. And also, like this, because when you have a socialized healthcare system and you can't have it inundated because then private companies are going to foot the bill. Okay, so there are vaccination issues. It's the first time we've noticed, hey, like maybe it's completely different here. Then you start to look at things and you realize that these Canadian hockey players that grow up in Canada where it's freezing cold and where hockey is the sport, the personality of a lot of hockey players is like they don't want to be famous. So playing in markets like Edmonton and Toronto and Vancouver and Montreal, there's a lot of pressure. You couple that with the fact that taxes are so astronomically higher in Toronto than they are across the border in Detroit. Canadian teams are having an insanely difficult time finding free agents and retaining people that they draft because the guy's like, I'm looking at what the Panthers and the Lightning are doing. I'm going to make millions more just living there, just by not having to pay these taxes. And there is no solution. The only possible solution is to go to Parliament and be like, hockey players can pay half of taxes. Because otherwise, and you realize, I've been making fun of Canada for years about how they never win the Stanley Cup, and California and Florida and Nashville are significantly better. Texas has a Stanley Cup since the last time Canada, a Canadian team, won the Stanley Cup. Many teams have been close, but they haven't been able to get over the hump. We just saw one of the best players for the Calgary Flames sign with Columbus, Ohio. He's going to make millions more. And he's an American, so he's not particularly emotionally tied to Canada. The best hockey player in the world right now, arguably top three, is from Arizona. He plays for Toronto. It's an open secret. He's not staying there. I think they literally are not allowed to pay him the amount of money that he is worth after taxes, which is one of the craziest things. We see this in Major League Baseball and in football. Like, people don't want to live in New York. People want to live in California. Canada is way worse than that. And you pair that with the fact that the Canadian markets are so out of control. It's like SEC football. You're like, do I want to be stressed out and make millions less? No, fuck off. I'm out of here. Which has created a situation where the people that care the most can't ever really, really, really threaten to win anything, which is objectively a bummer for those people. And those teams are fucked.
So understanding that that Canada had the easiest path to the Stanley Cup they're ever going to have when they had the weird bubble year during COVID, the way that worked was there were four divisions, and the NHL just split the teams up equally.
Right.
And they had the teams play within that division for the ones that qualified and were, you know, still eligible at that point in the season when they canceled it in March. And the winners of those divisions would go into a playoff. And Canada was its own division because the players couldn't cross the border for like legal reasons. And so Canada like pretty much was gifted their best chance at ever winning a Stanley Cup. The most recent opportunity before that was when Vancouver made it all the way to the Stanley Cup final. And that city fucking exploded when they lost to Boston. Unbelievable. Just violence, destruction. Like, think of everything that happened in 2020 in America. That happened in Vancouver because they lost at sports.
It wasn't quite as violent, but like it was very close to race riots. It was bad.
People lost, like, smashed and looted, cars set on fire, people hurt all over the place. Like, the city of Vancouver embarrassed itself and demonstrated just how, like, it's one thing to be a fan of sports. It's even one thing to be a passionate fan of sports. It's another to be a lunatic with misplaced values and a sense of importance.
Right.
And when your city explodes because, like, strangers are less successful at a sport than other strangers, you have completely lost the fucking thread. Yeah. So Vancouver has put Canada permanently on my hockey shit list.
Yeah.
And the fact that they can't retain players because of systemic high tax issues, because of governance in the country, players are incentivized to leave. Fuck them.
Yeah.
I mean, change the system, or maybe the teams can get more money. I don't know. But I'm certainly not in favor of giving Canadian teams special rules for the NHL where they get like a higher salary cap to account for taxes or anything.
No,
that
definitely not. No. The league shouldn't change the rules. If Canada wants to change their laws, they're a sovereign country and more power to you. And to be very frank with you, and this is part of my American heritage, I suppose, hockey players are more important than average citizens. And if you want the millionaires in your community, you should incentivize them, make a deal with them. Say, Austin Matthews, you don't have to pay these many taxes. Thank you for being here. And if you don't want to do that, then don't cry when he goes to Phoenix, which is objectively not as exciting of a market as Toronto. He doesn't give a shit. It's where he's from. And he will make millions more a year living there. So
Have you seen the Arizona Coyotes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so that's another thing.
Arizona State.
Which is another thing, like, this is just me
and
my heart.
That's the funniest thing in the world.
They're playing at Arizona State because they lost their lease with the Gila Arena, which is in a terrible location for a professional sports team. But, like, for me on my high horse, the fact that hockey has failed in Atlanta and Houston and is now failing in Phoenix, these are three of the top seven cities in North America, top 12. And in the United States, and it is
failed there.
Do you
mean like population size or
Market size, which is like it's market size. Yeah,
I'm pretty sure you were right the first time. I feel like Phoenix is like the fourth biggest city in America. Houston is like the fifth biggest city in America.
Yeah, it depends on if what you count like Guadalajara and whatnot. But yes, like enormous cities, and it's failed there, and it's failed in lieu of Calgary, which is a big city and is kind of an underrated city. Edmonton, Winnipeg, these places, that's fine. I love that the game is growing, but the fact that it's failed in those markets and they've continually allowed it to fail is another existential crisis. How the fuck is there hockey in Winnipeg, but there's not in Atlanta? Atlanta, they were one of the most cultural, like biggest cultural icons in the Western Hemisphere. There's no hockey there. There's no hockey in Phoenix. Like they're in a college arena. It is failing. But I have to care about the Flames. Like that to me is another existential crisis. Canada's involvement, the NHL's corporate offices should move to Detroit, Chicago, or New York, and we should get some Wall Street bros on the money part of it. We should get some NYU people on the marketing side of it, and let's grow the game. Okay.
No, we should let Vegas get on the marketing side of it.
There we go.
And I will say this about Canada. The Economist magazine, or newspaper, sorry, the Economist newspaper, just ranked their top most livable cities in America.
Oh, yeah, number one.
North America. Calgary is number one.
Yeah.
So if you want to take the word of a bunch of seasonally depressed, sad, nerdy Brits who have probably never been to Canada at their word, then you can feel good about that.
Calgary. I listened to the episode where they talked about Calgary, and it seemed like they were just so aghast and disappointed that it wasn't Vienna. And like, okay, that's some snooty shit. Like, Calgary is a place too.
Yeah. I don't care. In my mind, Calgary is just Winnipeg, and Winnipeg is the place where Michael Scott went in the middle of November in that episode of The Office when he goes on his intercontinental flight.
That's right. Okay, so coming up next, we're going to welcome on one of Chris's college buddies who's also a math nerd. He'll tell you where he went to school. We're going to talk about the National Football League. So let's throw it to our conversation with Dan right now. All right, Chris, let's do the National Football League, and we have a buddy of yours from your days at, you know, it's really interesting that We really haven't nailed where you went to college, which is surprising because usually with you people, it's like one of the first things you talk about. So where did you go to school, Chris? And where's your buddy from?
Well, Nick, Dan and I went to the greatest institution of higher learning probably in the history of humankind,
State of
the University
Indiana,
of
yes.
Notre Dame. Mm. And at that university, Dan made a name for himself as arguably one of the most analytically honed minds in the entire campus. Dan is an incredibly smart guy, incredibly thoughtful, especially when it comes to sports. Like his ability to pick apart and diagnose what's going on with sports teams, programs, leagues, trends sports-wide, it's really incredible, and I'm very, very excited that he was willing to come and join us to bullshit about this, about the state of the NFL, especially like the overtime rules. They're a bunch of horse crap, and Dan has always got something great to say, so I'm really excited to hear from him. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks, guys. Really appreciate you having me on, and you know, looking forward to talking NFL with you.
So if you're analytically minded, you must be up a huge amount of money gambling, no? Or no, it's not?
No. House advantage.
Yeah. NFL apparently is the hardest one, which is something that I can attest to. So let's talk about the NFL overtime thing has become a huge thing. And it's kind of always been a huge thing. But as social media has become more prevalent and TikTok and Twitter and players have started to voice their concerns, the NFL has been forced to address it. So in the history of NFL overtime, for the most part, for many years, it was sudden death, which is kind of stupid if you watch football because you could just kick a field goal. Well, they agreed that it was stupid. And in 2010 and 2011, the National Football League changed the rule so that if you score a touchdown on your opening possession, you win. But if you only score a field goal, then your opponent has an opportunity to match field goals until there's a winner. Immediately in the playoffs, Denver walked off on the first play of the game, and they're like, oh, well, the rule change has kind of not solved that. Now that teams just have an incentive to score touchdowns, they kept it the same way. They shortened the amount of time during the regular season. It's still first possession. If you score a touchdown, you win. If you kick a field goal, then your opponent has the opportunity to match or beat you. And the thought was that it would incentivize aggression. It kind of theoretically forces every team to have to play defense. Fast forward to 2021, the 2021 season, the Buffalo Bills and Kansas City Chiefs play perhaps one of the greatest NFL football games anyone has ever seen. Definitely the best quarterback duel I've ever seen between Patrick Mahomes and Josh Allen. They're going back and forth and back and forth. And in overtime, the Chiefs win the coin toss. They go down the field. They score a touchdown. Everybody walks off. Of course, this happened to the Chiefs with Tom Brady doing it to them. And it happened to the Falcons with Tom Brady doing it to them against Matt Ryan and Julio Jones. And now finally, everyone has agreed that each team is going to get the ball. So, Dan, the overtime thing is really weird because theoretically, half of the game is offense, half of the game is defense with a sprinkle of special teams on there, but football has become so offensive heavy that it's not fair to allow the team that wins the coin toss to just get offense. So like, where are we with the rules right now?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think even with both teams getting the ball, the rules still skew heavily towards the team that wins the coin toss for a couple of reasons. Number one, I would argue that quarterback is the most important position in any sport. You know, it's really, if you have a good quarterback, you have such a huge advantage in football. And number two, just as the game goes on, it's actually easier for offensive players to execute and do what they're supposed to do tired than defensive players. So the longer you go in a game, the more the advantage is going to skew to the offense.
So Dan, for the non-football aficionados among us, in other words, for our mom, pretty much, who's our only listener who doesn't understand football, I think. Can you explain why the quarterback position is so important? Because there's 11 guys on the field for both teams, and you know there's a mix of running and passing in football. So why is it that this position makes it so important to win the coin toss, and why does that change like the odds of winning in an overtime under these rules?
Yeah, so, I mean, the quarterback, besides the center who's going to snap the ball to the quarterback's the only guy with the ball in his hands on every play. And it's such a demanding position. You know, if you drop back for a pass, under the best case scenario, you have usually 4 to 5 seconds to either decide where you're going to throw it, step in, make a throw, or take off for a run, get out of the pocket, do something to affect the game. And so that puts so much demand on a single position. You have to make the reads before the play happens. So you could be up there, you could, you know, get the play from the coach, look at the defense, say, no, that's not what we're doing, change the play. Then you get the ball, you've got 4 or 5 seconds to decide, you know, am I going to throw? Am I going to run? And actually execute on that. At the NFL, the margin for error is just so small because everyone on that field is an exceptional athlete. And a lot of the times, if you look at the tape, you know, the quarterback might be making a 30-yard pass. And if they mess up the angle of their throw by just 1 or 2 degrees, that's the difference between a perfect pass and a touchdown and an incompletion or even worse, an interception. And so there's just so much demand that's placed on that position. I would argue, you know, on the entire planet, there's maybe 10 people who can do it at an elite level. And even there, you can pick up 4 or 5 quarterbacks that are even a step above a lot of those, you know, kind of, I'll call them second tier elites.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's exactly right. So, and that's a kind of a deeper issue with NFL football, is that the problem with expanding is that you can have 40 teams, you can have 10 teams in Europe, but there are only like really 15 to 20 competent quarterbacks. So you're just going to bring in 15 teams that suck and are looking for another one. That's why football has become so fun in the last 5 years, is because Philip Rivers and Tom Brady and Drew Brees and Ben Roethlisberger, Eli Manning held on. So we had, for the first time ever, a lot of really good quarterbacks, or reasonably good quarterbacks, at the same time. So it was really fun. So you're right. I agree. The quarterback is the most important position on the field. So because it skews offensive heavy, but the problem is, right, if you have Josh Allen versus Patrick Mahomes, Patrick Mahomes versus Tom Brady versus Matt Ryan, you're like, I want to see the MVP have a shot here. So how is it fair? Do we know? And like, this is the most egregious part of the game theory, why it's a problem to me, is that the game is over, but we can't definitively say who the better team is. And if that's how the game ends, then you haven't played a game at all. You've just kind of fucked around. And that's my problem, is that right now, if I wanted to look people in the eye and say, like, I don't think that the Chiefs are better than the Bills, I know that they lost the game, I still don't think that, and I don't think that there's conclusive data. And that, to me, is the kind of heartbreaking situation.
Yeah, I would agree. And that's really the issue, where both teams need to have an equal opportunity to get the ball and win the game. And I think that we've seen, since the NFL changed their overtime rules, to have you get a touchdown, you win, about half of those games, one quarterback has ended it standing on the sidelines without even a chance to get the ball. And it's ridiculous, especially in these playoff games that are, you know, being decided by the best teams in football. And they're so good that 60 minutes can't decide a winner.
Right. I've made this point with Tom Brady people, like, twice in his career, he won the coin toss, and the MVP and the best receiver in the game were on the sidelines twice. That happened to him twice. That's luck.
So, Dan, let's jump to fantasy land for a minute. Let's say Roger Goodell gets ousted in a violent coup. Once the parade settles down and Danderson is named commissioner of the NFL, it's your world. You have free reign. How do we change the overtime rules? Because it seems like the fundamental problem is that the coin toss is a factor here. And it's sheer luck is more influential than the talent and skill and preparation of the players on the field. So, Dan, I know you've mentioned some cool ideas to me, like, outside of the show here. What do you think could be a way to address this coin toss deciding the game's problem?
Well, we're going to just get rid of the coin toss. And I think, you know, what we're going to do is keep two principles in mind. Number one is that you want each team to have equal opportunity to get the ball and end the game. And number two, the NFL is fundamentally an entertainment product. I watch football because it's fun and I want to be entertained. So here's my idea is we're basically going to do an auction. And if you think about an auction, if you've got something that's, you know, up for bid. I know baseball cards have been really hot right now. Just, hey, whoever's willing to pay the most gets whatever's being sold. In this case, you're going to pay in terms of field position. So what I would propose is, instead of having captains come out to the field for a coin toss, you're going to have, you know, Patrick Mahomes and Josh Allen come to midfield, and the referee is going to, you know, turn to the visiting team and say, where do you want the ball? And, you know, let's say Josh Allen for the Bills says, we want the ball at midfield. And then he turns to Patrick Mahomes and says, all right, you can either let them have the ball at midfield, or you can bid a, you know, further back, more distance to score a touchdown. And Mahomes can go, no, we'll take the ball at the 40. And then Allen can come back and say, all right, we'll take it at the 30. And you go back and forth. So think about as they play out this auction, backing themselves up further and further, you're going to get to a point where, say, you know, the Bills say, we're going to take the ball at the 10-yard line. We're going to have to go 90 yards to score a touchdown. And Patrick Mahomes, the NFL MVP, is going to have to either say, yeah, we'll back it up further, or nope, I am voluntarily going to put myself on the sideline, not take the ball, and trust my defense to be able to come out and stop you. Because fundamentally, these quarterbacks, and keep in mind that these are some of the most competitive people on the face of the planet, are going to have to either put themselves in an increasingly more difficult position, or they're going to have to say, nah, I'm good. I'm going to risk watching my team be eliminated from the playoffs without touching the ball.
Yeah, and so
that is an interesting idea.
It was proposed by none other than pseudo hero Jim Harbaugh's brother, John Harbaugh, the head coach of the Ravens. He kind of suggested this. This is a game theory concept. Game theory nerds, like real mathematical game theory nerds like us, kind of came up with this. And he proposed this for real, and everyone was like, oh, that would definitely solve it, but that's weird. No, we're not going to do that. However, it would create maximum drama. And you would love to see number 17 and number 15 at midfield, which is, it's really interesting, a sidebar that like they're the 1% of the 1%, and like we're doing this for these two players specifically, and kind of like Justin Herbert and Russell Wilson.
Pretty much only them, actually.
Yeah, essentially. But like, we saw this, and it happened. Man, the drama of that would be absolutely bananas. And to like have to maximize your team's chances of winning, like what would you do? I mean, it's tough. You have to bank on your team being able to pull it off, I suppose.
Well, and I think that the really interesting thing is, inevitably, if we do this a couple times, you're going to have these coaches, you know, with all the analytics and whatever, telling these players, like, nope, once it gets to the 15-yard line, you're just going to say, all right, let's put the defense out there. And I would almost guarantee to you that some quarterback is going to just completely disregard what the coach says and keep pushing themselves back. Not only would it create maximum drama in the game, but the post-game press conferences would be some of the most interesting ones that I've ever seen.
Yeah,
it'd be like when Hasselbeck, it was Hasselbeck Green that Bay. Was like, we're going to take the ball, we're going to score.
Yeah, in Green Bay.
He just like immediately throws a pick six. Like, I would love to see somebody try to explain themselves like, well, you know, I thought if we got the ball at the one, I could drive it 99 yards on single drive and get us in a position to score a touchdown. But it turns out the other team is also elite and professionals, and I put myself in a position to fail, but I would do it again every time. Yeah. Like, I would love to see people talking about
it. Yeah, no doubt that would be interesting to me. And like, I think it's kind of interesting because if you have some sort of advantage, you can make different kinds of decisions, right? So if you're the Rams, I think the best Rams defense ever was like statistically not true, but the best Rams defense that I ever saw was not the Jalen Ramsey version, but the 2018 version where they went to the Super Bowl with Aqib Talib and Jamal Peters because they had Ndamukong Suh and Aaron Donald. And if you're them, you're like, we'll play defense at a certain point because we know that you can't do anything. Conversely, if you had, say, Jonathan Taylor or Derrick Henry, you're like, we'll take that shit at the one-inch yard, at the one-inch line, because either you have to go play against the pass or you're going to spread out and we're just going to run Derrick Henry and it's a home run threat from 99 yards away. So like, I think it allows you to maximize what your team does best.
Yeah, that kind of breaks from a lot of the other game theory scenarios that we've talked about kind of on the show. So like if you think like a prisoner's dilemma, there's a clear mathematical decision about what constitutes a rational choice. And the key factor there is that everybody who's in the dilemma, both the prisoners, have exactly equal information and exactly equal odds. And the rational calculus is simple. I should not cooperate with my buddy. Even on the stag hunt, even when the odds are changing a little bit, like the payoffs are disproportionately good for cooperating, and like the rational thing to do is to cooperate. Here, I think it's a little less clear. And Dan, you said analytics is going to play a big part of this because it's not just, you know, what's the optimum field position to take here, which, and as a sidebar, I think you know, the 20-yard line, 25-yard line, like the touchback distance is probably going to be like the inflection point where you see a lot of teams starting to be like, all right, well, maybe we shouldn't take the ball inside our own 20, but the 20-yard line is like what we can consider to be reasonable. I think, like, Nick, you're right. Like, how your advantages are and how prominent they are, especially this late in the game. You played an entire game of football, and now you got to, like, count on those advantages to manipulate the odds in your favor. Like, I don't know that it would be just the same results every time with one offense agreeing to take the ball at the 25-yard line. I think it would be there would be some play there, and I think that would be super, super interesting from, like, a strategic point of view. It would generate a ton of conversation, both during the game and, like, in the aftermath. And I think it would make for a really, really entertaining product at the end of the day, because it gives you more to talk about than just who made a spectacular play. It's did somebody make a boneheaded decision, or was somebody a strategic genius?
Yeah, and the amount of variables that come into play here are enormous. And you can think about, where is the game being played? Is it a dome, you know, perfect conditions, no wind? Or is it, you know, January in Lambeau Field in Green Bay, or in, you know, Boston, where you've got a negative 10 degree wind chill? You know, do you have some trick play that you've been sitting on since training camp that you think you can bust out because here's the optimal moment to be able to, you know, throw this play out there and try to score? You know, is your star wide receiver banged up, but you've been trying to keep that under wraps, and you know that, you know, hey, you know, we might have this MVP caliber player, but he's playing at 80 or 90%. So the amount of decisions that you have to go through and figure out about your team, the other team, the conditions, are really just enormous. And it's going to lead to situations where two teams value things differently, possibly even on different days or in different places.
Yeah, truly. I mean, like, doing this in a late game in Buffalo in the middle of winter has a very, very different, I think, set of calculations than doing it in Los Angeles at 5 o'clock in the afternoon in that gorgeous monument to sports they have out there. I mean, it's literally a different ball game. And I think with all the factors at play, that would just be so much more interesting. At the very least, it gets us away from the stupid coin toss. Like, all the money, all the effort, like this huge, like, industry that the NFL is, for the results of the actual contest to come down to pretty much a coin toss. It's just so silly. And, like, if for no other reason than to get us away, like, completely eliminate that from the game, I think this is just a really, really fun idea, if nothing else.
It's kind of interesting to me because all of this just stems from the offensive explosion that's happened, because theoretically the coin toss is meant to be 50-50, where defense was half of the game. So you would want to play defense often if your defense was good. Like, that would be a reasonable choice. But because offense has become so much more skewed, like, the rules have become so skewed to offense that you have to be on offense. Like, defense can't win you a ball game, and it just becomes this cycle of crap where defense isn't part of it. And it reminds me of this thing. In college, you flip a coin and you get to decide if you get the ball first or second, and then the team that loses the coin toss gets to decide which end of the field they played on, and you would go back and forth. I think it was like first and 10 from the 10 or the 25, I think. And I'll never forget that's right. And I think I'll never ever forget when Joe Paterno against Ohio State in a whiteout in 2011 decided not to worry about who got the ball first and just demanded that they play in the student section. It was one of those rainy Big Ten games in November, and nobody had scored. It's like 11-11 in overtime. And he's like, I don't care, first or second, just go down, make sure they go down there. And immediately, I think the quarterback was whoever was quarterback before Pryor, or maybe it might've been Young Pryor, threw an interception right away. It was immediately over because he knew, like, this is an advantage for us. But now with the analytics and the heavy skewing towards offense, like, that, those days of, like, defense and crowd control and stuff, that seems kind of essentially over, and that's why the coin toss is kind of bullshit now.
Well, and in the NFL, you also don't have, like, the stadium is generally, like, bigger and louder and more exciting. It's a more produced atmosphere, but they also don't have, like, things like student sections. I mean, yeah, it's going to be the home team's fans pretty much distributed throughout the entire stadium, so it doesn't really matter. Like, you wouldn't see a decision like that in an NFL game.
Right. I do want to switch to one other game theory topic that I had in mind, which is this quarterback supply issue, and Dan is uniquely positioned to comment on this because his Chicago Bears are going through some sort of weird rebuild. I guess sort of we as Lions fans are too, because there aren't a bunch of elite quarterbacks. Teams get caught in this... they get caught in this this chess concept called Zugzwang. And Zugzwang is a really interesting game theory idea, I think, which is you have to move. Every move you make sucks. Like, you're going to lose. The Lions were in it last year. The Bears are in it this year. And what Zugzwang means in the NFL would be like, what we would like to do is just pass the season. None of this matters. We would like to fast forward to the rebuilding phase, but you can't do that. So, I like, for the Lions, they played mostly a bunch of walk-ons last year because if you treat it like a 17-game preseason, that's a way to take advantage of your Zugzwang. But like the Bears are going through this year, and I think, I guess you could probably say the Seahawks and maybe the Texans, they're just kind of skipping a season. And that, because of rookie quarterback contracts and this dearth of quarterbacks, a lot of teams are just electing to be like, fuck it, we'll be good next year. And it's kind of, I think it's, we're going to get to a point where it's going to get out of control.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. I think that we know that the recipe to win in the NFL has predominantly been get a young quarterback on a cheap deal and build up a team around him. If you look at the teams that have been, you know, winning Super Bowls recently, that's usually the formula. Or you have some, you know, situation where Tom Brady is willing to play for less money and not a market deal so that he can win a bunch of championships. But you have to have that cheap quarterback. And it's an issue, not just in the NFL, but in other sports. Like, look at baseball. Look at what's happened in the past 10 years. The Cubs and the Astros tank and win a World Series because they're able to, you know, figure out if we suck and we can draft, you know, Carlos Correa and Chris Bryant and be picking at the top of the draft and get those cheap players plus the free agents we bring in, we can win a title. And I hate to say it, but I think that's where we see the NFL going, where you're going to have at any given time, you know, half the teams trying to push their chips in and win a championship and half the teams trying to just suck so that they can make that transition. Because what do you get for constantly, you know, winning 8 or 9 games? Maybe you make the playoffs, maybe you don't, but even if you do, you're gone the first weekend. So it is a real problem. And compared to other sports where there's mechanisms to solve it, I don't think that there's a great answer for the NFL high level because there just aren't enough talented quarterbacks to go around.
So, and the NFL is also one of the only sports left. I think baseball too, but baseball draft, I mean, prospects, it's just a crapshoot. It's the only sport of between basketball, hockey, and football where the last place team gets the first overall pick. The other two sports have a lottery to prevent this exact thing. Like the Penguins got like a top two or number one overall draft pick 3 out of 4 years or something, and they were able to create a dynasty that is still going right now. You see the same thing in basketball. People had to get rid of that problem. They even had to adjust the odds because the odds of the lottery were still too heavily favored toward the team that sucked the most. I did hear an interesting proposal, though, years ago from, I think, Mike and Mike in the Morning to prevent tanking and to fix the lottery, where the lottery would be most heavily weighted toward the team that most narrowly missed to the playoffs, which I think is an interesting game theory solution where you have to try. You can't just quit.
Another one that I think is really interesting is, have you heard about the gold plan in the NFL?
No.
Or the NHL?
No.
So the NHL's gold plan is really interesting. What they say is, starting the day you get eliminated from playoff contention, you count the points that you get. So, you know, NHL, 2 points for a win, 1 point for an overtime or shootout loss. And so what it does is it incentivizes teams to win after they've been eliminated from the playoffs. And in theory, the worst teams get eliminated first, so they have the most time to accumulate these points. But if you're totally tanking the season and not trying to win any games, you still won't get enough points to draft number one overall. And so it incentivizes teams to keep winning even after the season is, you know, long gone and they're out of the playoffs. I think it's a fascinating concept.
Yeah,
that's really clever. Because we're big Red Wings fans, Nick, and we got spoiled for like 27, 28 seasons as kids. Like, we were pretty much born into this like decades long machine of hockey dominance, and now they suck. Yeah. They're just an absolute laughingstock for the last several years. And I remember watching a game this season. I got a little bit more into it this year, and I remember thinking, you know, it's April. These guys are, you know, they got a lot of young players, but you know, they know they're not very good. They've experienced the losses year after year after year. They know they're not in the playoffs anymore. What's really keeping these guys going? Or is it just like marketability to other teams or trying to negotiate some kind of new contract or whatever? You know, what is it that makes these guys want to win the game of hockey? And Dan, I think adding that incentive in there would be a great idea. And I don't know if like would something like that work in the NFL, you know, based on like the size of the playoff structure now. And like the fact that they don't have the 2 points for a win, 1 point for a tie, because you know there's no, you know, no ties in the NFL. Well, I guess there are ties in the NFL, aren't there?
Yeah.
Well, under our new overtime rule system, there wouldn't be.
Well, I would I would jump in there and say like I wouldn't have no regular season overtime. Like if you can't figure it out, there's no, like, it's on you. Like the player safety is an issue. I don't be bored. If we're not going to do a shootout and make it simple, like save that for the playoffs, in my opinion. Like if you don't figure it out, that's on you guys.
That's a good point. That's a really good point, actually.
I don't know. Overtime, I think, is kind of a silly concept in the regular season for all sports. I think soccer, international soccer's got some things right. And I think that that's one where they're like, yep, you should have tried to win harder, I guess. And don't incentivize a tie, like decentivize it, make it the 3-1. And we're going to talk about this when we get into the NHL portion of this program, but the 3-1 point system that FIFA has compared to the 2-1 point system that the NHL has, it matters a lot. So I guess, Dan, we'll get you out of here on the general question about how you feel about the NFL, because it seems like the draft makes a ton of money, and if the Jags are going to suck, at least people will care about them in the draft. So generally, I think that this overtime rule is a fun little microscopic thing for us to argue about, but of all of the sports in America, I think it's probably doing the best.
I agree. I mean, the fact that we're sitting here arguing about how do we optimize one small piece of the game that comes up just a couple times a year is a reflection of how great the state of the league is. The NFL has done a great job of, you know, putting an entertaining product on the field, engaging fans year round. Sure, it's got its flaws, but I agree, compared to all the other major sports out there, they're the one that's best positioned right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are going to end our program, Chris, talking about two leagues that are having existential crises right now, and that would be Major League Baseball and NCAA college football. So that should be a fun conversation. We're going to see, maybe there will never be college football again. Maybe Major League Baseball, with all those empty stadiums, what are we going to do? They're oblong-shaped stadiums. What are we going to do if they go out? So, Dan, thanks for hanging out with us. I think you got to get to a show, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I actually do. So I've got some theater tickets.
Okay, Chris, so that was your buddy Dan. It's hard to tell how you guys are friends, you fucking nerds.
Dan is a bona fide genius. He's probably predicted more correct plays during Notre Dame games than anybody that has walked the face of the earth. Like, I'd like to see him versus Tony Romo. He's also just really great at seeing macroscopic trends.
Yeah.
He's so good at identifying that kind of stuff, and I love hearing him talk about Notre Dame football because he's super well informed and he can answer all the SEC critics who have drunk the Kool-Aid and are somehow under the impression that Oklahoma and Texas are among the best teams in America or something. I don't know. I don't know conference.
I wouldn't throw stones at your conference, Chris.
I don't have a conference.
Yeah.
Not my conference. Hashtag not my conference.
I think you're going to be one of us.
Player 3, tweet it out right now. Hashtag not my conference. And then tag at GameTheoryPod on Twitter.com. Hashtag not my conference.
Notre Dame's going to be in the SEC. Which would be, for you, the disappointment of joining a conference, sure. But the middle finger to the Big Ten of joining the SEC would be worth that content alone. I don't know what I would do with myself. I understand that, like, it's tradition or whatever, like Christian values, the South and Notre Dame, a lot more in common than people think. Them and West Virginia. Okay, that's a good transition into our college football situation, where of all of the existential crises, college football is having the biggest. And I am going to throw out my hypothesis now, and we will argue about it later. The internet has ruined college football.
100%. That's just a fact. That's just a scientific fact. Now, I will say, one of my favorite places on the internet is the subreddit for college football. It's reddit.com/CFB. It's so much fun because everybody there is a fan, but they're also generally pretty self-aware for people who are making comments on the internet. It's like, what if YouTube was filled with people who weren't like 12-year-olds?
Right.
Like, the comments section is fun, and then sometimes like it's really informative. One time they had a really bright, shining moment when they discovered that Florida State was given a bowl during a season when they were in fact bowl eligible because of NCAA regulations, and nobody caught that. Like they found it independently.
That's amazing.
And it's just a fun place. But the internet has ruined a lot of aspects of college football, and I think it's done so primarily by concentrating talent in the same handful of markets and making it easier for players to make names for themselves so they can go to the schools that are already successful and make waves there with their social media brands and their notoriety and whatever else. And it just makes the game less fun because the same teams are competitive over and over again and nobody else is.
Well, I think, I mean, it's much deeper than that for me. I think that with the internet and with streaming and with keeping up with things, it also decentivizes casual fans from just watching the game that was on TV. It's like, it used to be producers and editors would decide the games that are important, and like, it was only recently, probably like 5-10 years ago, where you could literally watch every single game from the comfort of your own home, depending on what subscriptions that you have. You can watch everything. But before that, like ESPN would do game day. There's like 20 games on, but like you're not going to get Wyoming versus San Jose State if you live in like where I live in now, North Carolina, and that's fine. Until Wyoming is really good and they play Boise State, and ESPN's like, you need to pay attention to this game, and it kind of makes it regionally fun and cool. But now, there's no reason to pay attention to anything other than like the top 30% of teams. It's just the same. It basically has become a professional sports league. And this is compounded by the fact that because kids have the internet, when I say kids, I mean high school recruits, they can kind of be recruited nationally. Now, remember USC and Notre Dame and Alabama, douchely, used to say that they're the only places that could recruit nationally. And that was true for a long time because they had big TV contracts and they were famous in LA and Bear Bryant and Notre Dame, the Catholic school. But then with the advent of the internet, everybody recruits internationally. Like Utah kind of found a honey hole with the South Pacific Islanders. They were recruiting Hawaiians and Polynesians. And now everybody does that. Everybody recruits everybody. When that is the case, then you know, you're never going to get a five-star recruit from Wyoming to stay in Wyoming, like, you know, as an example, for the most part. And when they do, it's enormous news. So the internet has created a situation where not only fans don't care about anything other than the top 25% and their alma mater, but the recruits don't either. Like, why would you take a visit to Utah if you're from Utah when you have like the entire SEC recruiting you, unless you wanted to stay home?
Yeah. Well, Nick, I think college football's got a bigger problem than that.
Yeah, sure.
The games are so fucking long.
They're so long.
So
long. Oh my
god.
Everything we shit on baseball, college football's
worse. They're long and
they're
filled with not football. That's the big problem. So god. In 2021, this guy named Jay Paterno, writing for statecollege.com, I don't know if there's a relationship there, get past it. This guy was writing in the middle of the season. It was like an article from October 14th, 2021. And he's talking about how long college football games are, but they're not filled with more football. It's the same game, like the same time on the playing clock, but the games are just so much longer. So according to this guy, in 2008, the average time for a game to start to finish was 3 hours and 9 minutes. And when I say average game across the nation, I'm talking the big primetime ESPN overproduced products.
Division One, yeah.
Right. And that's averaged against, like, Army Air Force, against, like, Akron, Ohio.
Right.
So these games that are going to be a lot faster because there's less commercial time, there's less product, or less production value, that's averaged for a length of 3 hours. That's a pretty long time. And in 2008, that was longer than the average NFL time. So in 2020... that increased to 3 hours and 24 minutes.
Bruh.
But in 2021, that number continued to climb. So halfway through the season, with 61 of 105 total Big Ten games already completed, the average runtime for a Big Ten football game was 3 hours and 27 minutes.
3 minutes?
3 hours and 27 minutes.
The average went up 3 minutes. Average.
In one year. And then now this is for the Big Ten. So those previous numbers were national averages. So they're probably artificially decreased, but still, that's a long time. And at that point in the season, on October 14th, he was writing this. there are already three games in the Big Ten that went more than 4 hours.
Suck
Wisconsin, Notre Dame. Wisconsin, Notre Dame.
I remember that.
Indiana, Cincinnati, which two middling teams. Cincinnati had its best season ever, and Indiana sucks. So they average out to be middling teams.
Fair.
And Ohio State, Tulsa. There weren't weather delays.
Points.
There weren't like extra things going on, some external force that's acting on this game. It was just so fucking long. There is no reason for Ohio State and Tulsa to occupy anybody's brain space, including Ohio State players, for more than 3 hours.
Yeah.
There's no reason for it to go for 4 hours. And so when you talk about what casual fans do and don't need to care about, when you talk about what fans regionally do and don't need to care about, it's very, very hard to get new people into the game of college football, into the product of college football, when your games take half a day.
Yeah.
Your whole afternoon can be spent ostensibly watching one game. And by the way, according to this guy on Twitter, Joe Pompliano,
love him.
In the NFL, for a 3 hour and 12 minute game, there are 11 minutes of actual play.
Yeah.
College football plays last between 7 and 10 seconds. That's not a lot of sport. The clock is running the rest of the time, and it's commercials and halftime. You're sitting there watching basically 2.5 hours of commercials for in exchange for some football every now and then. And don't forget the sponsored scoreboards and the All-State sponsored field goal kicks.
Son of Beach,
the
sheet.
State Farm sponsored instant replay bullshit. It's just far too much production and too much advertising. And that, I think, is killing the sport of football.
Okay, so part of the situation with not having enough football to me is fine. Because like one of the great things about football is something happens, you digest it, you do it over and over and over again. The issue really is, A, the commercials, which you got to make money. Like, so,
there's just too many commercials.
There are too many commercials.
It's crazy. It makes me not want to watch.
Yeah, so there was an improvement. I think Allstate invented this, maybe Progressive, one of the car insurance geniuses, where they would do the stupid 60-second commercial anytime there was a kick, and they just did the commercial on like 40% of the screen, and they didn't leave the game, and I was like, this is astronomically better, because at least I'm still there. I know that there's nothing happening, and they got to walk the other end of the field anyway, fine. That is significantly better, because at least I'm watching it. The other thing is, halftime is stupid. I don't understand that pageantry is great. One band is fine, and if you can't get your performance done, the fucking halftime is like somewhere between 33 to 40% longer than a quarter. It's between stupid. 20 and 22 minutes.
It's stupid.
It is so dumb. The NFL does 12, and that's where one of the big differences is in the stupid halftime. The other thing, there are two other problems, is that they stop the clock when they get a first down. Now, those seconds add up to minutes. So they get a first down, and then as the fat asses are running down the field to hold the chains, which is technology that we're still using in the year of our Lord, chains, to hold the chains, they stop for 3 seconds so they can run down there. What? And that creates pauses in the game later so that 25 seconds turns into 5 minutes so that they can spike it. In the NFL, it's just run, which is like, I know that they have the technology to do that because my alma mater has a barbershop in their player salon. So I know that they can run the clock. All right. The other thing is that everybody figured out that the way to win college football games when you can't recruit with your opponents is to throw the shit out of the ball. Every time the ball hits the ground, the clock stops. I kill myself.
It's absurd. Like, clearly that rule was invented when they didn't have like closed in playing areas and they're like, well, like these little New York, New Jersey kids playing in Rutgers and Yale or whatever. Like, oh, the ball's gone over the field. We got to stop the clock.
Yeah, and like, fine. Like, incompletion, spike the ball. I'm even down with that. But the chain thing and then the halftime, it really is.
No. Spiking the ball is stupid. Spiking the ball, the fact that, like, okay, for the non-sports fans out there, there's a rule in football called intentional grounding.
Yes.
That is a foul when the offense loses yards. And to commit that foul, the offense has to have a player who is eligible to make a legal forward pass to another player on his team. However, that pass is obviously an inaccurate throw with the intention of getting an incomplete pass. The reason you would do such a thing is to avoid getting sacked, tackled for a loss behind the line of scrimmage, and to stop the clock. The parameters of such a pass are that the quarterback must be inside the tackle box. So those linemen up front, they make the tackle box. The width of that line is the tackle box. So you have to be inside that. And there have to be no eligible receivers in the area of your throw. So it's like clear that you threw this so far away from anybody that nobody could possibly catch the ball. However, late in games, teams will often run up to the ball, get set, snap it, and the quarterback will just throw the ball into the ground. He will spike the pass into the ground. He's inside the tackle box, and there are no eligible receivers in the area. And yet, that's just a legal play. We've just decided, now we're going to allow that one. That's not intentional grounding. He just grounded the ball on purpose. It's the dumbest rule in the United States of America. If you take nothing else away from this very long, very involved, very challenging podcast, take away that intentional grounding is inconceivably stupid and needs to be eradicated. John Madden was right about that.
John Madden was right about a lot.
Yes, he was. And he was on a broadcast. He said, that's a dumb rule. And I thought, you know what, John Madden? You're right. It is a dumb rule.
Yeah, so games are too long, and I agree. My wife went to Pennsylvania State University, which is like in the top 10 or 20 of colleges that care about college football.
Not even the top 10 Penn schools in Pennsylvania.
That she hasn't watched a game in its entirety in, I don't know, like 4 years probably. Like, she can't. I can't wait. I can't ruin a Saturday. I don't have it in me to ruin a Saturday. I can't. I just can't. I can't. At this point, games that kick off at noon and games that kick off at 8, 9 can do it. I can't ruin my Saturday. I work too hard during the week at a job that I don't love. I'm not going to ruin my Saturday. If a game kicks off at 3 p.m., I'm like, I have to...
Like you're gonna get invested in Penn State versus Georgetown or whoever they play. You're gonna get invested when Greater Northwestern Bumblefuck Tech A&M comes to town, like, has no scholarships, and they're going to get just absolutely smoked for 3.5 hours in Happy Valley. No, right. Nobody cares.
Yeah, the other thing I wanted to mention is that, and we'll get out of here quickly because I know that you and I sort of disagree on points of this. The other, and I kind of want it to settle out. Maybe we'll do this next year in a couple of years. Their name, image, and likeness ruling from the Supreme Court has allowed players to not earn $0 for existing. But as a result of that, college football teams are finding ways to kind of slip them money as pay for play. The numbers are reportedly astronomical, $5, $10 million from certain teams, which cracks me up because this is so new. It reminds me a lot of like the tulip bubble from the Netherlands or Holland or whatever that was. It's like a bubble. They haven't realized that, like, hey, as an oil tycoon, this kid, what if he sucks? So I think the market's going to adjust pretty quickly.
Well, this year. We'll see. I don't know. My buddy Mike, shout outs to my buddy Mike. He had this idea that I've kind of kicked around with, and it would kind of make sense. His idea is to just do away with the concept of amateurism.
Yeah.
It is a joke to think that with the millions and millions of dollars that these universities stand to gain from playing football on television and so much more from selling merchandise and tickets to home games and all this stuff, it is silly to pretend that these players have anything to do with amateur sports.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court's name, image, and likeness thing, I think, is like a basic... I mean, the Supreme Court made a ruling. It's like a basic rights deal. Like, people have the right to profit off of their own personhood. Right. Separate from that, my buddy's Mike idea was just completely divorce college football from college and create an institution that's in parallel to whatever university you think you care about and call it the University of Alabama Athletics Association, the University of Ohio State Athletics Association, the University of Mississippi Athletics Association. And players will go play for that team out of high school. That'll be their job. They'll represent the university's athletics association. They'll get paid in what accordance with whatever market value they deserve, which I think they're getting paid right now, their market value. And we'll stop doing this bullshit of like, oh, these guys are student athletes. Yeah. I once watched, Nick, I think you watched this game with me. I watched a CBS production of Georgia, South Carolina. Georgia's supposed to be a pretty good university. It's supposed to be a pretty good public
top 10 public schools.
Yeah, I'm sure it's top 5 in Georgia or something. I don't know. South Carolina is not supposed to be. I mean, these are major, like, world-class research institutions. And they're showing scholar athletes of the game. And I'm not kidding. One of the scholar athletes was the quarterback for South Carolina, whose grade point average was 2.4, majoring in sports and recreation management. If that's not a parody of itself, I don't know what is. Yeah. The delusion that these guys are students first. Like, maybe at places like Stanford. Maybe at places like Notre Dame. In fact, I can vouch for places like Notre Dame. But even so, it makes so much more sense to me to just create minor league football, because that's what people who want players to be paid. Like, you don't care about college football. You just want another minor league. Create a parallel institution and stop jerking around with the NCAA and this bullshit concept of amateurism. Let the players play in a separate league. And then at the end of the deal, like the way it's tied back to the university, according to Mike's plan, is the players, when they're done with their playing career, they either go to the NFL or they can go back and get their education.
They get admittance, yeah.
Yes. It just doesn't make sense to keep doing the charade. Like, players are going into the university with millions of dollars in their pocket from oil tycoons in Texas because they think this player is going to be the one that pushes A&M over the top or whatever.
Right.
Like, meanwhile, he's writing fake essays in fake classes, North Carolina, and just completely wasting the time and resources of people who could be spent, you know, helping people who care about their education.
Right.
It just doesn't make sense.
I think that that's where we're headed, because the money machine is out of control. But you are convoluting the people there that are trying to get an education. And I know that you went to Notre Dame and Stanford, but for the majority of us that go to state schools that are like that care about college football a lot, the football players are a problem. They're a pain in the ass to deal with. Like, they take, and they're very boisterous and popular and famous at 18 years old. And like, I don't blame them for that. But like,
It's a distraction. It's a huge distraction for somebody like imagine you're like a first generation college student.
Yeah.
You worked really hard, but didn't have any resources going for you. You tried really hard and you got into the local university of your dreams. Like, you're doing better than anybody in your family. And all of a sudden you got Johnny Famous, son of James and John and Eli Famous or whatever. And they're, instead of letting you like focus on your education, they're fucking around in classes 3 days a week because they don't have to care. They have to be there. They're taking your time. They're making the professor like babysit them. They're taking away tutoring resources that you could be using. They're a drain on your time. And oh, by the way, they're getting paid by your money to be there and you're not.
Right.
It's just stupid robbery for the sake of, like, what? Because somebody wants to watch their old alma mater win a national championship or whatever. No, create a separate institution, divorce it from the concept of amateurism, and move forward with minor league football. You can have the same colors, you can have the same uniforms, you can have all that crap, but it doesn't take away from the function of a university, which is to educate people.
I completely agree. And two final points before we move on to the association. One point is that was my idea for college hockey, was why don't these schools just buy junior teams and let them wear the fucking laundry, which is all people care about. And if they want to go to school, they can go to school, but they make 70 grand a year and they play hockey they wear Roll Tide and Oregon Duck stuff and they live there and they're like around and they live in the town, but they don't, you know, they're not required to pretend to go to school for 12 credits a semester. Like,
then they would actually be employees of the university. Like, student athletes, like, under the concept of amateurism now, like, I don't care what other people say, like, they are getting paid what they're worth. But that's because there's no minor league construct in place that would allow them to wear the laundry, as you rightly pointed out. That's all people care about.
Right.
They let them be professionals under a minor league and stop jerking around with this idea that students should be paid to do something other than being a student. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, and it screws their education. My last point, which is that the other athletes that are kind of amateurs, like, they give a professional level of effort, but the football players are in their fucking way. Like, these athletes are student athletes, and it is hard, and their scholarships are, and like, they're not making any money. They're kind of riding off the coattails of the state-funded stuff and also football revenue. And I'm completely down if football funds those endeavors or whatever, but if you're a soccer player or a polo player or whatever, then you have to deal with these football players that know they're more important than you, and like, it's a whole mess. So I agree, and I think that's very clearly where we're headed. The thing is, like, whether they're going to be a league, are there going to be revenue sharing models, at what point are we going to have a union? It'll get weird, but it is better than this convoluted, like, above the table, under the table shit that's happening now. And with that, let's move on to the association. Really depressing shit there from college football. But whatever. I mean, the games are long. I watched some of them.
I wish it was still magical too, but it's not.
It isn't. The internet ruined it. Okay, so the association, I want to shout out Stephen Curry and James Harden, who came up with some insane Nobel Prize winning math, which is that 3 is 50% more than two. So if you hit 40% of those, that's better than hitting 70% of twos. And they completely changed the way we look at basketball. Is it good? Is it bad? It is. And so people have a lot of interesting solutions. The three and the two is what we're talking about. We will talk about tanking and super teams. That's just the rich are getting richer and whatnot. But Chris, here's a solution. Have you heard the solution? What if we played by threes and fours, where that percentage increase is cut in half? And everyone's like, that would change it.
Yeah, this guy named Stephen Shea wrote this article for ShotTracker.com, which is a really cool, like, kind of statistics basketball site.
Right. Yep.
And he said in 1979, Washington Bullets head coach Dick Motta said, the 3-point field goal will definitely make things interesting. Like, I mean, you're right. But according to Shea, when he said that, he wasn't thinking, like, this will revolutionize the game. He was thinking, oh, a game that might have gone to overtime will be won because of, like, a desperation heave from far away from the basket. Since then, since the three-point shot was introduced in the 1979-1980 season, at that time there were 2.83 three-point attempts per game in the NBA. Yeah. So the whole game, whole 60 minutes, players are just shooting less than three times trying a three-point shot. In 2018, that number was up to 29, more than 10 times the number of three-point attempts take place in today's modern NBA. And that's because people did realize they had this like earth-shattering understanding of numbers that three is 50% more than two. So, Nick, I have not heard anything about changing the ratio. So the idea there would be what a two-point shot now would be three and a three-pointer would be four.
Right. So the analytics guys will tell you like the stupidest scoring in basketball is pickup basketball that is typically played by ones and twos.
That's
double. You should never attempt a 1-point shot in a ones and twos game. That's just stupid. Even if you're a 10% shooter, like it doesn't, if you're a 10% 3-point shooter and you're a 40% 2-point shooter, you should never attempt a one because the value, the payoff, it's very similar to what James Holzhauer did in Jeopardy, like double it always. Duh. But threes and fours, the ratio comes down enough that you would have to be so good at threes. And it reduces it to the people who are truly elite because what's happening in basketball now is people that are like, at threes are like, fuck it. Because like if it goes in, like my favorite player in the NBA right now, Joel Embiid, who's like the greatest internet, maybe athlete in the world right now. He's just so good at trolling people. He calls himself Troel Embiid. I love him. He takes like between two to five a game. And oftentimes, like when he's tired or whatever, he'll take a couple, but he makes about 20 to 30% of them. And when one goes in, it's totally worth it. And then they have to guard him and all this stuff. Like, you're not good enough to do this. If it was worth four and twos were worth three, you'd be like, there's no reason for you to waste everyone's time. Just go in the block or stay on the outside and pass the ball. And you get your James Hardens and your Damian Lillards and your Steph Currys, like they're going to shoot the fours because they're the greatest at this and that's their part of the skill set. So then you kind of reallocate the skill set back to the way the game is meant to be played. Right now, if you watch an NBA game with one or two guys that can shoot 30% accuracy from 3 points, there's like, it's not basketball. They just kind of kick it in and they look for the guy that's going to shoot the three. The other problem is that, and everybody who's seen an NBA court knows this, if you see high school and then college with the lines a little bit further back and then NBA where the line's significantly further back, there is a straight line in the corner, which means that the corner three is in the true corner as much as 4 feet closer than it is from the top of the key. The percentage of hit rate on the corners is crazy. It's a solve like in a video.
All right, so let's pause. Let's pause. Because we've dived in.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we know even what the problem is. So in case you're having trouble following with this, the alleged problem that we're trying to solve with this random reassignment of values to points in basketball is that the flow of the game has changed. By the flow of the game, I mean the content of the shots and the plays and the offenses. It looks different now than it did in the 1970s. And to some people, as Nick said a second ago, that's not basketball. I think that's a bunch of horse shit, but let's describe the phenomenon that's taking place. All right, so with the advent of the three-point-based strategy, the distribution of shots that take place during a basketball game has changed. So if you're looking at the court from the top down, if you're looking at like half of the court, you can see the three-point arc and the basket kind of at the baseline here. The shots distribution used to be, okay, the logic is you get closer to the basket, you have a better chance of the ball going in. Makes a lot of sense to me. Before 1978, almost all the shots are like clustered around the basket and are pretty much a symmetrical distribution, and they kind of get sparser and sparser as you move away from the basket. It's like a semicircle. When the three-point came into being, there grew this line of distribution around the three-point arc because teams started to shoot more and more and more shots from that range. And what that did and what that's done over time and what it's doing now to an even faster degree is it's eaten away. It's what is so-called the mid-range shot.
Yeah.
So if you think of shots in like three categories, there are shots that are right near the basket. So layup. like layups, like big guys grinding down low, putting fast the ball breaks, in the hoop,
dunks,
dunking, yeah, stuff like that. That's a close-range shot. The three-point shot is shots beyond the three-point arc. So mid-range is pretty much anything between that, like, right under the basket zone and the three-point line. And the percentage of mid-range shots that have been taken in an NBA game, since 1998, it was just under 40% of shots that take place in a basketball game are mid-range. In 2018, that number dropped to 19%. So less than half the number of shots taken from the mid-range as were taken 20 years ago.
Right.
And that has been almost entirely replaced by three-point shots. And so people are arguing, well, that's not exciting because you don't get as much of like the true basketball offense with players trying to go down and drive and make passes and all this kind of stuff. They just kick it to the outside and lob it up. I would argue that people need to get off their high horse with that. And they're starting to sound like the unwritten rules baseball type people. They're just complaining that the game looks different than it did back in my day. And you got to deal with it. You got to figure out how to play defense better and change the way you approach the game.
Yeah, so the idea that it's a problem is only a problem because the same people, James Harden is the ADBC of basketball because he also figured out different rules violations that people weren't taking advantage of, so he drew more fouls than anybody that's ever played. He figured out how things that were, that's a foul, and he could get people with the ball movement, like they foul him all the time. That loop has since been closed. It's like there's a James Harden ruling now, and like it's a different kind of thing. But what has happened with this is that we've lost, and I'm going to say we lost, like I don't really care that much. I'm just saying what you get out of going to these different sports is different, right? For hockey, it's very much like NASCAR or a concert, like being at the game or watching the game. It's like cocaine. It's just pure adrenaline vibes. When you go at football, there's like a chess element. And then there's like this gladiatorial element. There's some violence. There's some strategy. There's some amazing manipulation of this little thing. With basketball, it's all what the human body is capable of. I would argue that the most amazing athletes on the planet are defensive ends, tight ends, and basketball players. What they can do with their body is it's indescribable. But with the three-point shot, that's not what we're watching anymore. What we're watching is essentially golf, and people are just hucking this shit up. And because at the three-point line is at a certain point, there's no incentive for them not to just keep going further and further back because it's not possible to defend a three. It just isn't. You can defend the three-point line, but they just keep moving back and back and back and back. If you remember, in college basketball, it's a problem. I mean, I said not a problem. It's a solution. It's a strategy, whatever. Jimmer Fredette did that. If you are like Damian Lillard or Jimmer Fredette and Stephen Curry and you're 40% from way the hell back there, that to me counts as being amazing. But when I'm watching Joel Embiid just huck it up because like mathematically it's better to take a shot, it's like playing the lottery. It's like, and again, basketball is basketball, and I'm not saying that it should be one way or the other, but I am saying that people are like, I genuinely don't want to watch this shit. Because I'm watching this in person, I'm watching online, I'm watching on my TV because I want to see Joel Embiid and I want to see LeBron James like move their bodies in ways that like we didn't think was possible. But because of this, it's not happening, and there's no real end of it. It's going to keep being this way.
So this reminds me of something called the Fosbury flop. Does that mean anything to you?
No, hit me.
So the Fosbury flop is a technique used in track and field high jump. So For the longest time, the event of the high jump in the Olympics in track and field involved somebody sprinting up to a bar and kind of diving over it face down. Mm-hmm. And along came this guy who in the 1968 Summer Olympics completely changed the game. His name is Dick Fosbury, and he totally changed the game by, instead of diving over the bar like you would see like a dog bound over a fence or whatever, he sprinted up to the bar, turned his body position, and flopped backward over the bar. Mm-hmm. People thought it was laughable. People thought it was silly. People thought, this is nonsense. What are you doing? You're ruining high jump. And all it did was give him records. All it did was completely revolutionize the sport of high jump. It was legal. It was completely allowed. Just get over the bar. And he did. And he did so by changing the way he approached the game. The complaints about the Fosbury flop sound like the complaints about basketball now. Like, yeah. Just because somebody is less entertained by something doesn't mean that it's somehow a problem. Like, I don't know. I think it's making for more interesting basketball, but
I think it's making so that there's another tool in the holster for teams that don't have one of these freaks, which has kind of made things. Like, the positive part of this is that it has made things much more equitable in a way that it wasn't in the past, because you don't have to have a LeBron or a Jimmy Butler that can do all of it in order to compete. But what is happening now is that the people who are the freaks that can do the stuff down low, they're also learning how to shoot threes better than everybody else, which would solve the game. If someone with Steph Curry's ability was 7 feet, Steph Curry now can't guard that person, but that person can guard Steph Curry. We're in a situation where we're right back to where we were. But what I would like is a balance. And what I think the 3-4 thing will do is balance, like, the strategy of being a sniper from half court, don't even care, and also needing to play like a full, well-rounded game. Because I completely agree that, like, finding a solution and another aspect of skill, like watching James Harden step back and just pipe it, is insane. I love that. But I don't want, I want it to be compounded with, you know, a good run game, so to speak. That's what I would like. And this is, all of these sports have one thing in common. When you hear people complain about the refs or whatever, blah, 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 when people start saying the product is bad, that's when we have an issue. And everything that we're talking about right now, this entire episode is about, when is the product bad? In baseball, games are too long, it's too boring, and the people are like, they're robots. And in college football, it's too long. In basketball, it's very predictable, and it's not exciting when this is the case. So I think my point is, I think switching to 3-4 would be a big solution for that.
My question is, why not 5-4? Why not make a 3-point shot 5 points?
Why not 7, and then you have to or 6, and then you have to make a free throw?
Why not 5-3?
We'll go 6, and then you have to make a free throw, and that makes it 7.
But what if you score on your own basket?
That's
2 points?
Yeah, that's a good question.
That's 2 points.
That's a great question. So, Chris, the general point is, I'm going to watch all this shit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to watch all the college football I can. Yeah. I'm going to watch sports. Like, they have me. They got me.
I love Shohei Ohtani, and I'm going to watch every single pitch of the Subway Series when it happens, and I'm going to bitch about it the whole way. And none of you can get mad at me. I'm going to watch the whole thing.
I don't blame you.
Yeah.
Frankly.